This is the PhD cast. GroupM's global boss, Dominic Proctor, said that the online data trail is not good enough yet to beat broadcast. We talk about how online's performing against its broadcast ancestors. Also, the IAB Australia Awards, best in show for GPY and Oz Mobile Medic. We talk the merits of that and media agencies in contention in awards. Plus, Spotify, can artists really make money from the platform? If that wasn't enough, Stu's off to Adelaide, Peter was late, and we talk collaboration amongst media agencies. I'm Chris and the gang, and this is PhD Cast from PhD Australia. Hello and welcome back to the PhD Cast. Joining me this week are podcast regulars Nicola Davey.
Hello.
And Stuart Gurney.
Hiya.
And from Team Digital, Lauren Oldham.
Hello.
And Peter Hunter is joining us, but he's not here yet. So at some point, Peter will come in. And at some point, Stu, you've got to go. Is that right?
Yeah, the tag team.
Should we get on with it?
Yes.
A very eclectic week this week. Let's kick off with Tuesday's report in ad news that GroupM global CEO Dominic Proctor has declared the industry is being seduced by online's ability to measure stuff, but it's still not working properly for advertisers. Mobile devices are the industry's biggest issue, where classical advertising will not work and new models are needed for advertisers to earn the right to deliver commercial messages to users. He said, I don't think anybody has found the optimal way of using social media in the same way that people have found wonderful ways of using broadcast media. He went on to say, if you're commuting on a train, people, generally speaking, are not lingering around banners. They're just getting past them. I'm not sure that just applies to commuting on a train. That was Dominic Proctor in Tuesday's Ad News. Big voice in the industry talking about new models for new media. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's... I actually kind of agree with him, actually. I think there's a lot of talk of online being a holy grail and a measurable... making everything really measurable, which of course we know it does, but as we all know, measuring half of things half the time can lead to bad results just as much as no knowledge does as well.
Yeah, and I think new models are required for old media as well, as we are kind of moving away from just traditional push one-way messaging and broadcast messaging into more integrated and content stuff. Then traditional researching and models of reporting, impacts, impressions, involvement, all that kind of stuff, that has to move on as well. So absolutely, those things happening on digital platforms are in the same camp, for my eyes.
And I think what he's saying is trying to make a stand that just because we can measure in digital means we should overinvest in digital. And I think that's a very fair play.
I think
it plays a really important role in the consumer journey for lots of different brands. So understanding how that works is really important, and being able to measure that is really important. But let's not overestimate and put all our eggs in the digital basket, as it were.
Lauren, lots of eggs in digital basket?
Surprisingly, you might think that I'd say no, but I would actually agree. We're coming up to a bit of a... I think it's a topic we've talked about before in terms of viewability and... people being able to see ads online versus just tracking it. So, it goes to the point of we can measure that an ad was served, but we don't know that it was actually seen. When we first went out with digital advertising way back when, it was all about the click and the click-through rate. And now we're saying, you know what, click and click-through rate don't actually mean anything for a brand advertiser. You need to actually be doing brand studies or... you need to be looking at different metrics. So, we learn and change over time, and I think that this is just another stepping point and a big shift in online trackability and measurability and what we actually look as the kind of new metric to measure things. Mm-hmm. And, that it'll be influenced by other media as we go on and everything, but it's just we have to learn as we go and find what's working, what's not.
Do you think it's fair to say that online advertising created this trap for itself, and that to prove itself and to get onto schedules, it overplayed the measurability hand?
I think it comes down to how people's behaviour has changed online. So way back when, referencing kind of like Lauren's first foray into digital when we had click-through rates, which was really great. When you had more of a lean-forward, purposeful behaviour, then having a metric that could report back on that behaviour, perfect. But now digital's grown up, people's behaviour digitally has grown up and evolved and become much bigger than it just being a functional, you know, I need to go and do this thing, so I'm going to go and do it. I think their mindset.
But Chu, this was the great promise of digital. The promise of digital was that you could have scale and measurability. Is it that we could have our cake and eat it? Are we saying that's not the case anymore?
No, I think we can, but I think we should have to
change
in context,
measurability.
Well, put it in context of the actual consumer journeys and funnels that people go on. Mm-hmm. So digital is often a big component.
I often
of that.
Go on a funnel.
Well, I'm always on a funnel. It's a massive component of that, but then how do you measure in effect off an online relationship? And that is for me is the big part, and that's kind of what he's alluding to. So just because you can invest in digital and you can get measurability around that space doesn't mean that you can't invest in offline media and that delivers a return as well. So if we could work out a Pathfinder, which is PhD attribution model, way of working that in off and online media and driving that to both on and offline sales and work out what actually last exposure drove that conversion, that would be the ultimate holy grail across that consumer journey. So until we can find that, don't stop investing in ATL because it has a clear role, but obviously make digital as measurable as we can.
Yeah. I agree.
So talking of digital, this week saw the IAB Awards here in Australia. They took place during the week. GPY&R Melbourne, by far and away, took our Best of Show for their Mobile Medic campaign. The prestigious Best in Show for the campaign, which was developed for Defence Force recruiting, and that happened at the Star earlier this week. It was also named winner of the mobile platform or app category. Lauren, this campaign for GPY&R for Defence Force recruiting, tell us a little bit about it if people haven't seen it. What was it, and why do you think it impressed the judges?
It's been a while since I've taken a look at it, but I do remember it being a very well-executed experience. So it was extremely robust in terms of the kind of true-to-life experience that you would get, that if you were actually a medic in the Defense Force, what your experience might be. So you're getting all these I guess symptoms that are going on in a person that you kind of put your mobile phone over and get an augmented reality experience with. And then you, as a medical student, would real-time have to try to identify things. And
it was an app that gave you an experience of diagnosing someone's issue with your phone or medical problem live in real-time.
Yeah, and awesome. So you could take your phone and scan over their body and look at their x-rays. So just like you would have to be looking at a full x-ray and try to figure out what was wrong.
And the bodies were on posters, yeah. So it was poster mobile interaction.
Yeah, and it was executed on university campuses, so they got to target directly to, you know, medical students. And, you know, it's just, I think, a very well thought out, very well executed campaign. And it also gave a true to life experience of what it could potentially be like if you were going to be a medical worker in Defence Force.
Well, it certainly impressed the judges. Samantha York, who's the acting CEO of IAB Australia, said that GPY&R Melbourne is to be applauded for its brave and polished mobile campaign execution. Its use of augmented reality for educational purposes was truly innovative, but most importantly, it delivered clear and tangible results for Defence Force. And that's what interactive advertising is all about. So off the back of the comments from Dominic Proctor, here we've got an example where innovation delivered through digital seems to be getting tangible, demonstrable results to a client. What do we make of the campaign?
Well, Lauren, just to clear podcast listeners, Lauren was actually a judge and looked at this, so she'll probably be more clued up than the rest of us. But
full disclosure.
Is now.
Having looked at it, I didn't get any level of results, to be honest. I didn't understand how it actually delivered against its promise, which was the objective for me. It was about how do you get people to... How does the Army, the Defence Force, recruit medics? Makes sense just to target universities, absolutely, from a media point of view. But to me, that there was no closing of that loop to prove how that activation actually made propensity to become a Defence Force medic more likely. Did it? Anyone else? Mm. Did anyone see that? See that metric?
I can't declare knowledge of any results in that area. But
and I was going to say, I don't think I'm allowed to divulge anything that we discussed in that room.
You probably can't.
There were results. So in terms of what you enter into the IAB, there are, you know, like the strategy, you set up the business objective, the strategy section, and you talk through the creative execution and the media execution, and then you have a full results section.
Yeah.
So, you know, each of those areas would have had to have been met in terms of actually, coming out on top.
And so within that, without disclosing, there was measures that demonstrated.
Yeah, so they would have set out what their objective was at the beginning, and then the judging panel said that the results show that they've achieved their objectives. So the objective that you've identified, again, I can't remember, and probably couldn't disclose anyway, but I don't know if that was the same objective that they've written in their brief. So it may or may not be, they may have had a different objective in terms of
how they've written the award.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, but then it goes back to an industry thing about if we've got great examples of work, why can't we demonstrate the results? Because that's going to inspire us to be better and make greater cases across industry.
Yeah, there's not a lot of competitive activity happening around other armies in Australia that could leverage the campaign results.
The voice of Peter Hunter, who's joined
the voice of reason.
I will happily say, actually, that it's a very close mimic of the New Zealand Defence Forces campaign that was launched about 4 years ago by Saatchi & Saatchi, which used augmented reality in a very similar way via billboards to drive recruitment for the New Zealand Armed Forces. So quite similar, using gamification and various other bits and pieces. But nice evolution of a creative idea.
I guess for me, the IOB Awards, having looked at the winners, what's noticeable is the absence of media or specialist agencies, which feels such a shame because digital and mobile especially are areas where media thinking and right context can absolutely make the creative idea live and breathe.
And this isn't unique to IAB Awards, is it? I think it's fair to say that most media can lions aren't won by media agencies.
No.
What's going on?
Well, I think everyone's seduced by creative, and that's that's the thing that you see as well when you're trying to show in your campaign how amazing it was. If the creative was amazing, you're more likely to probably get, you know, the award than if you had really bad creative, but you had an amazing media plan and execution. So I think that's an issue, is that we do tend to kind of put a bit more emphasis on creative. And one of the things that did concern me was just, you know, hearing some people over the last IAB Awards talk about getting rid of the whole media section in the award entries, and I was like, no, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
And we'd never win.
We'd never win, but two, you know, how would your ads get out to everybody if they didn't have media placements and smart people placing them?
But also, not even just placement, but quite often we work with, airway partners and actual production partners who actually take our media ideas and activate it in creative versus creative being put into a media space. So there's not enough of those examples in these awards, and that is a massive shame because, I mean, even from a PhD point of view, we've got great examples from TikTok and other clients.
Yeah.
Admittedly, we probably should have put them forward, but there's also just a lack of representation around the stuff that we can produce in this digital space, which was a shame. And for me, I think some of the examples of the work that won awards probably isn't awesome either. So as I said, I picked up that point around lack of results or tangible results that I can see in that great example, and that looks like a great creative case study. What would make it a great communications case study would be really clear results, and I think that across all of those examples we're just missing some real tangibility.
Cool, brilliant. Now, Stu, it's nearly 4 o'clock, which means you've got to jump to Adelaide. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
We're going to
talk Spotify, and we're going to talk collaboration next. Have a great weekend.
Bye, podcast listener.
Listener.
Out. Pages. Okay, from that to Spotify. And this week, The Guardian UK reporting Tom York's comments that artists, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, artists, not, certainly emerging artists, not making money from Spotify. Sam, he came under a lot of criticism for saying that. Sam Duckworth, who writes for The Guardian, has kind of come to his, has come to his support, acknowledging that 5,000 streams of his last album earned him less than £20. He commented that 4,685 Spotify plays of his last solo album equated to £19.22. That's 0.004 pence per album, which is the equivalent to him selling two albums at a show. And he goes on to say that he doesn't blame the consumer for this problem. It's unfair to criticise those who've opted out of torrenting to replace it with legal subscription streaming. The problem lies in the rhetoric of the industry. We've talked about Spotify before, and it's relevant from a whole media consumption role of brand point of view, and that's the angle I want to take on this. We as advertisers or the people who invest money for advertisers, are they putting money on Spotify in the knowledge and belief that ultimately everyone could and should win, right? People get music they want, advertisers get revenues, an innovative media owner gets revenue, and our brands and advertisers get exposure. Is that happening, or is that simply not the case?
Doesn't seem to be the case, judging from Tom York's experience. And I think that what are they to do? Do you say that all inventory is going to be increased, and that the impact, the media impact within that environment becomes a greater premium because the artists that are driving essentially that platform need to be greatly better remunerated from it? And would advertisers be willing to pay for that impact? Or do we just say, tough luck, you've got to go and find money in another model?
It's an intriguing thing, because there's bands, like there's a Kiwi band.
God, is there?
There is.
Just one.
Just the one.
Fat Freddy's Drop, and they're a Wellington dub band. Started on and took the attitude of the fact that the internet would be a distribution channel, and that they needed to work their butt off to tour, and the digital media and all of the streaming of their content was getting the word out, but that it was about the live show, driving fans, getting fans along to touring, and the idea that if they could build ultimately an audience, that they could leverage that long term. They're now bigger in Europe, miles bigger in Europe than they are in New Zealand. They've got a sold out US tour coming up, and they're now leveraging that as in the sense that they have an audience. So I think bands that are smarter treating it like what media are, where they're going, if I can create a following, that following has a value attached to it.
Mm.
And it's not about...
In the long run.
It's not about making 2 cents every time someone listens to it.
Spotify is just one of the tools that I have to do that.
Yeah, and Fat Freddy's Drop is a really good example. Love YouTube. They love things like Spotify because it's spreading their tunes.
But it's not a replacement for anything. It's purely a tool that's part of the kit.
Absolutely, and they see it as being really vital to do touring and live gigs to drive the message. And they're just trying to build a property in their band,
which should be the thing that floats artists' boat, is being able to actually go and do play their music with a crowd and share it. And would they want to, the opportunity cost for them is, do they want the likes of Spotify to be inflating advertising spend, which will then turn away advertising revenue and dollars, which means that they won't have a platform to be able to get their music out there and be able to bring people into their thing and what they do.
Yeah.
It's a great, for them, an owned platform that they can leverage.
Yeah, it's that build it and they will come. Well, they won't. You've got to actually work at getting your music out there as much as Spotify needs to do it.
Just because
you built it doesn't mean you should be paid.
I totally agree with that. I think it's really interesting because I feel like these comments are a little bit like the music industry was when they were kind of going, oh, we're going to totally deny that there's streaming and people are moving to digital channels. They kind of, like, they kept trying to extract as much money out of the album as they possibly could.
We've chosen the time to record the podcast when about 30 people in various forms of heels have chosen to literally frog march around the building. So then, that it's not the sound of our of anything other than high heels. Sorry, Lauren.
No, it's okay. I think that these comments are basically what the music industry used to be saying about trying to take as much money they still could out of album sales. And then they started realizing that they needed a kind of a multi-revenue approach where they said, okay, we're going to do concerts and get money out of concerts and everything. So it's doing all these other, selling merchandise, doing all these other things. And I think that, you know, you shouldn't expect that, you know, Spotify will save you and provide you, you know, your 100% annual salary or whatever. You need to still diversify and do these other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, from my point of view, it's very interesting, and I think that it kind of reflects a very local and close to home debate, which started last Friday when Paul McIntyre wrote a piece in Ad News that the industry was literally getting what it deserved in terms of its lack of investment in trade magazines. A piece that was then responded to by Tim Bowers from Umbrella on Monday. What Paul McIntyre said last Friday was that what you're in for is more of what we see in some trade titles today: lightweight tabloid style yarns, beat ups and narrow angles, usually negative on anything that generates online traffic. You get blatant, relentless daily editorial self promotion of higher margin conferences and events. Because they're consumers, we trend setting industry types want coverage without paying for it. But embedded in that is that idea that you get promotion of higher margin conferences and events. And it's almost like he was positioning that as a negative, where the Tim Burrows' response to that was he makes no apology for having higher margin events off the back of that as part of his business model. So a really close to home example, I think, where industries just have to evolve. The way that you do what I do, the way that you make revenues, have to evolve, and no one actually knows that more than media agencies. We are not immune to this. You know, the way that we make money, the way that we make revenues is changing as well. And that has been, you know, by no means an angst-free existence for the last few years in Australia or any developed media market.
Yeah. Can I just have a whinge that bloody Beyonce tickets have gone? And so if any media owner out there wants to donate a $200 ticket for Beyonce, $200 a ticket. That's what's happened to this industry, music industry, in terms of, you know, think about
experience.
But yeah, and exactly to Chris's point in terms of, so I'll be able to get her album for free now, but to be able to get access to her, I've got to pay over the odds to go and actually then, she's got to make revenue in another way.
Which, well, I'm imagining Beyonce is fine for revenue, because she's charging $200. Five people, easy grand. But that's fine if you're an artist at the head of the tail. The challenge is if you're in the tail, and that's exactly what trade magazines and trade publications in the broader context of the press, that's the context they find themselves in. And that's that. Finally, this week, let's talk collaboration. So, also happening this week, talking actually of trade magazines to do higher margin events. It's been mad week all this week from B&T and our friends over there. And I went to an amazing session at the start of the week in the afternoon. I went to their Innovation Afternoon with some great speakers. But what I want to talk about was the last session, which was a panel debate. And it was a panel debate essentially around who should lead innovation? Who's in charge of leading innovation? Is it advertising agencies, media agencies, clients? And of course, the easy answer to that is that it's
everybody.
Everyone, of course. Everyone and no one. Everyone's in charge of innovation, which gets you to the really obvious place of collaboration. The innovation actually is a result of collaboration. Some really interesting points of view. Rob Galuzzo, I'm going to say, made the point that collaboration between agencies is shithouse, what he said. So the dialogue's not great, and actually collaboration between agencies turns into a really difficult way to get great work out. And very quickly that panel debate became about a lack of collaboration and strategies that we can be brought to bear to do that. What can we do to engender better collaboration, greater collaboration amongst clients, but specifically amongst their agencies? Because it was certainly a big theme that emerged, that it's one of the biggest opportunities that we can get better at.
I think one of the most important factors is that the client has to lead and expect collaboration. So if the client is either relying on one agency to kind of drive everything and you know, that might, you know, obviously not support a collaborative environment, or there also could be, you know, if the client say basically saying, we want all of you to work together, we expect all of this to happen, then that the collaboration will happen.
Yeah, I mean, the buck stops with the client, so the client's going to be the one that says, I expect in a setting a minimum standard of collaboration. The teachers in the room, and that's what I'm expecting.
Yeah. I think the buck stops with the buck as well, really, and I think
the buck stops with the buck.
The buck stops with the dollars, with the buck.
Ah, good turn of phrase.
Thanks. And because if you imagine situation A, client gets all their agencies together, got one brief, I want one idea, when you all to collaborate. Exactly to Lauren's point, they've got the reins of driving that collaboration and having the expectation. Yet, what happens when those agencies go back away, work together, come back together? They're all being motivated by different business models and different ways to be able to bring in revenue to their agencies. So imagine situation B, client goes in and says, this is a pot of money, you're all going to get equal share of it, but the idea has to work. I think that they would get greater collaboration and willingness, because there's a secure revenue that people therefore don't have to be threatened by losing.
Yeah, but in my experience, the whole get everybody in the room, everybody work together, is actually one of the worst ways to get people to collaborate, because everybody starts fighting for their own piece of the pot.
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting... I mean, I think the other thing is, one of the things I know we do at PhD is
of
we
course,
say that...
Sorry, I should say, I'm interrupting.
Sorry.
If all agencies were on retainer, that wouldn't be the case.
True.
But there we go. Sorry,
just
go on.
And kind of coming back to what Nick's saying is, you know, as a media agency, what we do is we book media, but we also have great consumer insight that can bring great ideas. So the ideas aren't necessarily just the domain of the creative agency anymore. But if you sort of sat down and said, like we do at PhD, where an idea can come from anywhere, and that if creative agencies, as a good example, could start to believe and understand that, it doesn't threaten what they do, because that idea, and a media agency is never going to bring that idea to life in a creative fashion.
No, and creative agencies are masters. They are amazing.
Yeah.
At actually delivering ideas and packaging them up and making them look, feel, and be amazingly polished and experienced.
And
they're amazing at it.
And we're incredibly good at delivering the reach for that idea.
Yeah.
If we kind of did
involving spaces and places to disproportionate ROI, which comes from individual use of media channels.
And a one plus reach.
But
and
there's
so
also a load of other agencies, sorry to mention that, there's also a load of other skilled people that work in production or might work in the technical side of things that would also be able to come up with an incredible idea that just would need the brand guardianship from a creative agency. Like, we all know this stuff, yeah, but it's a case of, well, creative agencies need to make as much money on production. Historically, media agencies need to make money by actually booking media. All of a sudden, it creates a tension that shouldn't be there, which I think is everyone agrees with.
Well, and I mean, not only is it important for the client to be there, but it's also important that the agencies are there in a collaborative spirit. I mean, we've worked with some great creative agencies where we've come up with some amazing concepts just by the sheer fact that we've wanted it to work and we wanted to make an awesome campaign for a client, and I think that's the important part too, so the spirit of the agency.
Finally this week, a big, big, big congratulations and well done to our very own Richard Johnson, who's been named as one of B&T Magazine's 30 Under 30. And that's
it. He
is staggeringly under 30. Congratulations, well done him. And that's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Nicola.
Thank you.
And Peter.
Thank you.
And Lauren.
Hi.
That was PhD Cast. Happy weekend, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Behaviour as well with online. So way back when, behaviour online was more maybe action orientated, so therefore having a metric that could then provide a a number of people. Sorry, podcast listeners, that was a little ramble again. Okay, I'm going to start that bit again.